Good morning, everybody. Am I unmuted? Can you hear me? Can't see you. You can hear me? Yay, 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 yay. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Whoa. So we are in the week of Ki Tevo. See what's happening here. So let's see. This is a talk about, in part, about the tricky mind. So meditation is a way of learning what's clunking around inside this body, heart, mind at any given moment. You could say that it is simply bringing non-judgmental curiosity to the stories. The kvetches, the longings, the dreads, the oys, and the joys that comprise this human life on a wild and complex planet. And in doing so, we cultivate some perspective that we are not so much puppets to the bossy or frightening inner slave driver and outer demands that attempt to make us ever new and improved. So we bring kind attention to those layers of this life, watching the hopes and the disappointments as we bring some compassion to the whole ganze business. So we use the word meditate as a shortcut for simply paying attention with what's ongoing, with the ongoing focus to the flow of reality within us and surrounding us. And when we turn our kind attention to the risings and passings clunking around inside, the stories lessen a bit their hold on our bodies, hearts, and minds. But the mind is tricky. My mind somehow got the message that we're supposed to be new and improved, as opposed to what Malila Hellner Eshed said when she visited TVZ, that our job really is to wake up. And meditation can help us awaken to the way things are for me and for you, for this world, so that we can be part of the healing, or as Cornel West puts it, so we can be a force for real good. But this life in this world is not easy, in case you haven't noticed. Maybe we catch ourselves turning our meditation into another goal to achieve, another self-improvement, turning us into a project. Trying to get out from under the decree of our sadness and incessant stories of the mind. I think I often turn to meditation in the hopes that it will make this human passage easier to maneuver. But in a way, you might say that it makes things worse. As we grow the capacity to open to the struggle of this being human, there are multi-billion-dollar industries that seek to turn us away from the awe and miracle of having a human life. It offers us the lotions and potions to feel better, to look better, to act better, etc. Yet our practice does the opposite. It gives us the strength to open to that which makes us even more sensitive to the variegated journey that we are living. We can't help but tune in to the whole spectrum from joy to sadness and back. When we awake, we feel it all more deeply. Secretly or not so secretly, we long for things to be better, both in our lives and in, please God, this world. So when we welcome this week of Torah, portion Ki Tavo, it's a parasha that is full of many blessings and many curses, which of course sounds a lot like daily life on this planet. Many blessings and many curses every day. The parasha hints at a potentially great teaching for our practice of awakening in the midst of an unfathomable life. We hardly notice what's arising if it doesn't have a valence of wanting or not wanting, liking or not liking, pushing away, or trying to hang on tight. When you literally turn towards what is quote unquote painful experience, you get to watch what's arising and disappearing. The mind is busy with what it must do to keep you safe or to get you off your tush into action. Or vice versa, stop running around and find refuge in the next breath. This mind has a long list of its wants, like, for example, being a better meditator, or partner, or friend, or activist, or source of compassion. When I peek into this cauldron of the mind, there is so much sneakiness. Like, this is what happened to me the other day when I was meditating. I was dutifully trying to pay attention to the comings and goings of the mind, body, heart. Like so many pennies clinking around a jar, or clinking around this inner space that I call me. I watch the blessings and the curses parade within me. But the tricky mind is content to lead us into fantasy and storytelling, plans for the future, dread, or imaginary delights. So, okay, in our practice, we instead get to turn toward what the parasha calls the promised land. This unfolding of being as it is, seeing the stories, the hopes, the disappointments, the fear, some of it is painful and tight, and some of it expansive and heart-opening. Some of it gorgeous, some of it egregious. When we turn towards whatever is arising with tender curiosity, with open-hearted observation, we enter the promised land. It doesn't mean that it always turns out feeling good. When we sit with what's not wanted or uncomfortable, and join with that moment, there is transformation, there is insight, and there is, dare I say, love. The Hebrew word for commandment, mitzvah, can also mean enjoining, which I interpret as getting close, aware of being enjoined with the mitzvah of this moment, with this moment, this ever divine unfolding, this that can open into spaciousness to experience the blessings and the weeping and the unending shenanigans of this human life. You may notice that we instinctively turn from aversion, judgment, doubt, our own or others, and that only deepens the suffering as the curses pile up. So with that in mind, in the middle of one of my meditations, predictably, a big chunk of anxiety rose, and I did what I've often taught others to do: welcome the painful emotion, see how it does, how it lives in the body, watch the instinctive pushing away, and bring some loving kindness, etc., etc. So, wow, one day I was cavilling over the awareness I had to see the anxiety and its proliferating stories around it. But then I invited it to be close instead of unconsciously pushing it away. But all the while, the feeling of fear tightened in the pit of my stomach. And I tried to practice what I preach and bring some loving kindness to it, etc., etc. And I think the mind was silently hoping that all of these moves to be with rather than turn away could turn the flow of curses into a flow of blessings, or at least offer me some deeper comfort from the anxiety. But alas, no matter how many times I've given or heard these meditation instructions, like stay in the present, witness the rise and fall of the mind stories and bodily sensations, anxiety remained staunchly palpable. Then, in the midst of my meditation, I suddenly noticed that the mind was indeed just trying to get rid of that scary stuff by being a good meditator. So I tried, okay, I'll just bring the pain close. Okay, I'll breathe with it. But suddenly, in that moment, I saw just how much all my meditation efforts were, in effect, wanting the pain to go away. And in my surprise, I burst out laughing, and then seeing opened up for a split second, illuminating how the mind connives to push away and be free of pain. It was only in that moment of laughter, of letting go, that the shift happened. Seeing the mind's covert operations to wiggle and wriggle out of this moment of reality, desperate for less fear and more what? Comfort? Ease? I am in awe of the mind's hijinks, with its continual attempt to make things better and try to avoid what it doesn't like, which unchecked only makes for more tsuris, for more struggle. Only in that moment of seeing the mind's efforts did the pain evaporate in the belly, flutter away and disappear. Yahoo! What a relief and joy. Then I saw the mind pat itself on its proverbial back for bringing the light of awareness to the struggle of pushing the moment away. So, yay, the anxiety was gone for a moment. I sat smiling with unusual peace without having to make the present different from what it was, even giggling a bit. And in the midst of trying to preach and practice my own preaching, shift happened. Only when I could see how I was bringing the tough experience close in a clandestine move to make it go away did that moment grant an awakening, catching me red-handed, trying to meditate myself out of dread or pain, trying to escape the anxiety or fear. And all I could do in that moment was to laugh, the belly laugh. For a belly now less clenched in trepidation for the next moment. That trepidation sometimes deepens for me as I learn to live with a mind that is increasingly undependable. The Buddhists have a cool system that describes what I experienced. It's called the Five Hindrances. The Five Hindrances are mental formations that hinder and block our awakening. They are 1, desire or wanting, 2, not wanting or anger and ill will, 3, sloth, I love that word, sloth or torpor, 4, restlessness and worry, and 5, doubt. And what was happening to me, what broke through in my experience without planning or trying, was seeing one or a bunch of those hindrances, although I wasn't naming them in that moment. Part of the teaching of the hindrances is that we can drop the story, the incessant eternal narratives that keep us out of connection and on our own habitual conveyor belts. By shifting our attention from the thrall of our stories to the way it feels, the way the stories make us feel, the mind shifts from being captivated by feelings and thoughts to notice how it makes the body, mind, heart feel. Wanting more feels like this. Pushing away, like this. Buried under doubts, like this. When I suddenly saw the mind's eagerness to wriggle out of suffering by meditating, the story was suddenly irrelevant. There was only awareness, awareness in this case of struggle, which momentarily dropped away. So in this moment, in our holy Hebrew calendar romp, it's incumbent upon us to segue now to Rabbi Alan Liu's book about these holy days, entitled, This is Real, and You Are Completely Unprepared. Rabbi Alan Liu wrote, in the month of Elul, we're supposed to devote ourselves to the regular cultivation of self-awareness. The month in which we begin the process of tshuva by shifting our gaze from the world outside to the consciousness through which we view that world. Language and stories, love and tragedy are inventions of human culture, but they are all matters of life and death, all real and inescapable. And even though we invented the idea of weeks, we die when our allotted number of weeks has gone by. Or perhaps God made the reality that all this human culture seeks to articulate. Perhaps God made a profoundly mixed world. A world in which every second confronts us with a choice between blessings and curses, life and death. A world in which our choices have indelible consequences. A world in which life and death, blessings and curses, choose us, seek us, find us in every moment. And we live the consequences of our choices. Perhaps God made culture so that we could express these things precisely as we have in every detail. It makes no difference. What makes a difference is that it is real, that it's happening right now, and it's happening to us, and it's utterly inescapable, and we are completely unprepared. This moment is before us with its choices, and the consequence of our past choices before us, as is the possibility of our transformation. This year, some of us will die, some of us will live, all of us will change. And there is nothing in the world more real than this. All of it accumulating for thousands of years until we are inexorably hammered into this moment of inescapable existential choice. Life and death, good and evil. And this is an immense reality. All of our resolutions and strategies for coping, all our attempts to manipulate reality, all our attempts to get cute with life, are thin reeds in the face of this immensity. And this is what is called heartbreak. Heartbreak is precisely the feeling that we have done our best. We have given it our all. But it hasn't been enough. not nearly enough. And this is what we mean when we say, God is close to the brokenhearted. The Sfat Emet says that the Israelites did not understand what had happened because every event in their day-to-day experience seemed unique in their lives. Sacredness is only apparent in retrospect, and only then could it be seen that every chapter was truly interwoven as part of their sacred story. Rabbi Sheffa Gold calls this the inner path to the Promised Land. We live our journeys in sacred time, with ritual, within ritual space. It's a kind of dream time, so that their power and blessing can enter our ordinary waking consciousness. Welcome to the Promised Land. One more line. The Promised Land is always very close whenever we are willing to enter and be intimate with life. A blessing of our practice is that it underlines and activates what we already know to be true. It reminds us of truths that we have forgotten. Okay, I'm going to stop there. You can all